problem is that HIV carries the stigma of the populations that it most impacts. The HIV pandemic has always been as much a social and political pandemic as it's been a medical pandemic. And until we deal with those political and social issues that create risk, we will not see an end to this pandemic.
That was Stuart Fisk, a certified registered nurse practitioner and director of the Allegheny Health Network's Infectious Disease Fellowship. I'm Nina, and welcome to June's episode of Contagion Community, the new podcast from Contagion, where we highlight the healthcare needs of marginalized people. In honor of Pride Month, this episode is devoted to LGBTQIA healthcare. Specifically, we'll be discussing HIV infection and how it disproportionately affects queer and transgender people. I'm joined by Stort and by Dr. Stephen Wolf, an HIV and addiction specialist at the Allegheny Health Network. Thanks for joining us today. Be sure to share your feedback of which infectious disease topics you'd like covered next. So could you both start by sharing a little bit about yourselves and your respective specialties?
Sure. First, my name is Steve Wolf. I'm an osteopathic physician, but also probably important to this conversation is I consider myself an LGBTQIA specialist. The reason why I kind of went this direction, my primary training is in family medicine and then afterwards HIV specialty. With that said, the reason why I went into the specialty is because as I was growing up living in Pittsburgh, I found that there were not many physicians who I felt comfortable going to take care of myself. Everybody that I went to was either closed the only people available were closed to taking new patients. So I spent upwards to 10 years trying to find a physician that I felt comfortable taking care of myself as a gay man. So that's why I really went into it. And I really thought that we need more physicians like myself out there that really understand what the community needs are and then goes forward and takes care of them.
Well, this is Stuart Fisk. I'm a nurse practitioner. I have been involved in HIV care, policy, activism, prevention, all kinds of stuff, probably since 1985. And as a gay man, have also been really concerned about how, like Steve said, how I get healthcare, but also how other LGBTQIA people get healthcare. So that's really, both of those things have really shaped the work that I've done over the last three decades.
Well, thank you so much for those intros and for sharing a bit about yourselves and your own personal investment in this space. And how did you become involved in caring for patients living with HIV?
Well, interesting enough, I actually went to Stuart and talked to him. It was probably over a decade ago. And my background, I got a master's in public health and infectious disease and microbiology. So I already had kind of a background in HIV clinical work, but I really wanted to jump into it a little bit more and make it a larger part of my practice. So I went to Stuart and we sat down and had a conversation about it. And from there, it was history. I really submerged myself into doing the HIV specialty and learned quite a bit.
Yeah, actually, Steve's been a great provider for us. And he picked it up well. He's a good doc. So that was was really great to be able to bring Steve into the work that we do here at AHN around HIV. Yeah, I mean, my involvement goes back to actually being a young guy who was trying to figure out his sexuality and hanging out in the East Village in New York and thinking, I got to figure this life out. And I was sitting in a cafe and I was reading, it wasn't the Village Voice, it was another gay newspaper. And it had one of the first articles about gay men dying of this weird pneumonia and a cancer. And I thought, oh, I wonder what that's all about. And it turned out to be the beginning of the AIDS pandemic. If you fast forward until the kind of mid-1980s, I moved to the Bay Area, was living in San Francisco, became more and more aware of people around me who had HIV, including colleagues and friends and coworkers. And I was working, I then got a job working for the state health department in California as a database manager, doing research on how HIV was moving through various communities, including drug users and gay men and women of childbearing age. I kind of quickly got bored with sitting behind a computer and decided to go into caring for people with HIV. So I thought about going to medical school, and then about 20 minutes later applied to nursing school. Never looked back. I was too old to become a physician at that point, I felt. So I became a hospice nurse, and I worked particularly in San Francisco with people who were really marginalized, who were kind of, you know, people who were drug users or people who had persistent mental illness or homelessness, immigrants and refugees. Kids would run away from home because they were gay. And we're living in pretty bad conditions in single room occupancy hotels in San Francisco. And so that really informed a lot of the work that I've done to this day of really trying to provide healthcare for people who really sit at the margins of society and our healthcare system.
And if you feel comfortable sharing, I'm wondering how you navigate caring for patients who, as you mentioned, are at the margins of society and are most at risk for HIV and AIDS when it also affects you personally and affects your friends and your community.
It's difficult work. It's incredibly rewarding. I mean, I have to say that, you know, the people that I've worked with and the populations I've worked with, and, you know, really across the board, but really those populations of people who really have been marginalized and disempowered, which has increased their risk for getting HIV, have actually really taught me not only be what I think to be a very good healthcare provider, but they've also really taught me to be a better human being. So I'm incredibly thankful for being able to have that experience with them and help them in that way, because they've helped me a lot become a better human. So that helps navigate, but it's a lot of tragedy. It's a lot of misery and stuff that you kind of deal with. And it's not easy, but it's rewarding.
Yeah, and I agree with Stuart. It's an interesting way of kind of growing into yourself and as a physician, because dealing or working with folks who have HIV takes a lot of patience. And it takes a lot of understanding of not only disparities, but trauma, because a lot of people, as they were young and going through some of the discrimination, created a lot of trauma that affected them for the rest of their lives. And we see a lot of that. So it not only do you have to be patient with the person, but you learn to be patient with yourself. It really helps you take a few steps backwards and in understanding not only the patients, but more about yourself.
And how would you both describe or characterize the current state of the HIV/AIDS pandemic?
That's a great question, and it's certainly a fully loaded question too. I think in certain aspects, we are improving. I think that we're going in the right direction, but then there are certain aspects of it where we certainly are very, very challenged. I think that's when we start looking at disparities, especially in the transgender community. I think that's where where we see the most. Like if you think about all the people who are trans, 62% of people who are trans and Black have HIV. That's a large number considering the amount of Afro-American folks in society as a whole. So, you know, I think the short answer is I think we're going in the right direction, but I think that we need a lot more work when we're thinking about the minority populations, and especially with trans folks.
Yeah, I would agree. And I just want to give a shout out to Steve, because he taught me a lot about providing healthcare for transgender people, which has been a real gift to be able to do that for patients in the same context that we're doing their HIV care and their primary care, so that they're not having to kind of shop around for specialists, you know, which puts more time and cost into their care. This is care that should be integrated into regular primary care. I think Steve agrees with that. So I appreciate what I've learned from him. And I think my patients have appreciated it too. So they thank you as well, Steve. I think the current state of the HIV epidemic, it's a really mixed bag. I mean, from a biomedical point of view, we've made huge, huge, huge gains over the last three decades. There's no question about that. But, you know, we still have 30%, 25 to 30% of the people who are newly diagnosed with HIV are being diagnosed at the end stages of that disease, which means that they have probably on average been carrying the virus in their bodies for at least maybe 8 to 10 years, which is sort of the average time between time of infection and time that somebody starts getting sick, which means that they haven't been being tested, because most of those people have been engaged in routine healthcare or emergency care or some contact with the health system, where they should have been offered what is, for the last 20 years, been the most been recommended that everybody get an HIV test at least once in their life. And what we see are people being diagnosed at the end of their life and often dying within a month or two or more of being diagnosed with HIV. So that's a problem. We do not test people routinely for HIV. If we did that, if we tested every single person in the United States for HIV, or even the majority of them, and we took every positive person and gave them what probably would be a single tablet once a day, they not only would not develop AIDS, they wouldn't transmit HIV to anybody else, and we could end the epidemic. So to have a biomedical ability to end a pandemic as tragic as this one and not do it because we're failing to give people a $2 test is really a bad thing.
Yeah, and you know, the interesting thing, Stuart, is when we're talking about testing, but you could even look at the use of pre-exposure prophylaxis or PrEP, so to prevent HIV. When they did a study in 2020 that looked at transgender folks and their awareness of PrEP and their use of PrEP. And when they looked at it, the majority of transgender women know about PrEP. And when I say majority, we're talking about 96% in the study knew about PrEP. Now, then you think about, well, okay, then that's great. They all know about it, so things must be going well. But the reality of it is only 32% of transgender women were actually using PrEP to prevent HIV. That's a huge gap that we have. And so that's something that we really need to focus on too, is not only the testing portion, but also once you get tested and you're tested negative, well, what's the good next step? We really got to get these folks on PrEP.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, I think those, you know, similar numbers exist around utilization of PrEP or even being offered PrEP. For people who are drug users, particularly injection drug users who are at high risk for getting HIV, are rarely, if ever, offered PrEP. And then, you know, also kind of, you know, people of color in general who have risk for HIV acquisition are typically not being offered PrEP or do not take PrEP. So we're really, and, you know, when you have a pandemic where the majority around the world and about half the people in the United States who become infected with HIV are people of color, that's bad. So again, we have the biomedical ability to end this epidemic within a fairly short period of time if we just had the will to do it. But the problem is that HIV carries the stigma of the populations that it most impacts. So our criminalization of how people have sex, how people use drugs, of, you know, the criminalization and kind of disempowerment around homelessness and things like that creates huge risk for HIV. And the stigma carries over to testing or to even talking about it. So we have a long way to go in that area. HIV, the HIV pandemic has always been as much a social and political pandemic as it's been a medical pandemic. And until we deal with those political and social issues that create risk, we will not see an end to this pandemic.
And on that note, you both have been alluding to this, but which populations are most disproportionately affected by HIV?
Well, I did mention about the Black or Afro-American community is disproportionately, and the Hispanic community is also disproportionately affected in the United States above what their white counterparts are as far as new diagnoses are concerned.
Yeah, people of color, transgendered individuals, gay men in general have, you know, as a larger group, independent of race or ethnicity, you know, have the highest rates of acquisition of HIV in the United States. Around the world, people who are injection drug users and heterosexuals also are very high risk. So really, I mean, what you need to do is you need to look at a population of people and understand, where do they sit in society? Are they at the margins? Are they at the bottom? Do they have political power? Do they have social power and social resources? If they don't, they're far more vulnerable to acquiring HIV than someone who does have those resources. It's not an absolute thing, but the risk is greater on those lower edges of our society, people that we push to the bottom.
And besides the risk of acquiring HIV, how does this stigma affect these marginalized people who are seeking healthcare in general?
Well, you know, I mean, if you look at the way people who come into the health system who are drug users, for example, are, you know, very often stigmatized, treated poorly, and then kind of a lot of their health stuff is dismissed or they're pushed aside. And, you know, with this kind of thing, well, when you get your drug abuse, under control, come back and we'll talk. There are ways that trans people and LGBTQ people face either subtle or not so subtle or blatant discrimination when they walk into a healthcare setting. They're not made to feel welcome. I mean, one of the things that we need to do is to signal to people when they walk into a doctor's office or an emergency room that LGBT people are welcome there. And, you know, there's ways to display that. You put up a rainbow flag, you do a couple of other different things, but that's often not there. So they're not getting the clues that it's okay to be here. And very often they're getting really strong suggestions that we really don't want you here. It's true of immigrants and refugees in this country. There's just so many populations that we don't provide good access to healthcare for. And those people, because of that, become at higher risk for getting HIV and dying of it. The Center for Inclusion Health, which we started here, actually grew out of the Positive Health Clinic here and the understanding of how disease differentially impacts people who are poor and marginalized. So the Center for Inclusion Health has really grown up to try to provide a lot of solutions for Allegheny Health Network to solve the problem of access for those populations. So we have a Center for Recovery Medicine. We deal with homeless and street medicine. We have trans health navigation. There's a lot of different programs that we have to try to improve that access to healthcare for those populations.
Yeah, and I think part of it even goes the whole way up to the chain of the folks that are taking care of these populations. I distinctly remember it was a few years ago that I had a patient who came to me, and when they went to the ER, ask the ER doctor about using PrEP. And the ER doctor said, oh no, you shouldn't use that. That's like chemotherapy and it will make you really sick. Which is, you know, it was misinformation and should never have come out of someone's mouth. Or, you know, I had another patient who was HIV positive and was in a large kind of conference room like setting in the ER where, because they just had a lot of patients, and a student came in and just said that HIV had nothing to do with the diagnosis at the time, but in front of a bunch of other people came in a medical student, said, how are you doing with your HIV, in front of a bunch of other people, And that created this, you know, this trauma of like, he never wants to go back to an emergency room again. Those little things that we don't maybe necessarily even know that we're doing unintentionally, or maybe we have goodwill, but we don't understand what it does to another person when you don't say it the right way. Or if you, with a trans person, if a trans woman comes into the office and the medical record doesn't have her preferred name, and then the front desk person says, "Hey, Mark," what they call the dead name, what do? It singles people out, and it's telling everybody in the room more than what that person is comfortable saying. So there's a lot of different things that we could do just as professionals to really increase the inclusivity of the folks that we're dealing with.
Yeah, we've done a lot of work here at AHN, and Steve's been involved in a lot of this, as well as our transgender navigation team and kind of advocacy team. They've trained literally thousands and thousands of people at Allegheny Health Network and Highmark, right, about the kinds of things that Steve is talking about. So training front desk people to think about how they're addressing a person when they come into the waiting room. If they're not sure of what's going on, to use neutral language or pronouns, things like that. And, you know, those are things that people, you know, like, why would they know that? Because we never talk about it. We don't raise people to think about these things. So if you don't train people, if you don't say this is a thing that we need to be cognizant of, people aren't going to do it. And I have to say that, you know, training our staff in the hospitals about how to appropriately address and deal with trans people has been incredibly successful and popular. Like, a lot of people, you know, I kept waiting for the emails to come back as director of the center, you know, saying, why are you forcing us to like go through these horrible trainings about these people? And it wasn't that. People were always emailing me saying, oh my God, thank you so much. So people are hungry for this kind of stuff, and they need to be trained, and there needs to be expectations set in the medical community about how you do this. So it just takes action. It takes stepping up and recognizing that something has gone wrong. It's interfering with people's health, and we need to fix it.
Could you expand a bit more on either what AHN is doing to really promote themselves as a space that's empowering for trans people and LGBTQIA people, or just the work you feel like you personally are bringing into the healthcare space to make it more inclusive and accessible?
Stuart talked a little bit about training the front staff people so that, you know, at the very, very start of someone's medical experience in the health system, they need to feel comfortable. So that has been one of our biggest success stories, because we started out in primary care, but then now we're doing it in orthopedics, we're doing it in hematology, we're doing it, you know, all the different specialties. So people understand exactly, if a trans person comes into the network, they want to feel comfortable at every step of the way. The other part is really the WPATH, which is the professional organization for transgender folks, has really pushed and stated that trans health should be primary care health. So it should not be, a transgender person should not have to go to an endocrinologist to get their hormones, to be treated with testosterone or estradiol. This should be the responsibility of the primary care specialties. And so that's really what we've been trying to do, is increase the awareness and also the ability of primary care to actually do the medical management for trans folks. The other thing would be is just expanding the access to get the not only the medical management, but also the surgical options that people potentially could have. That's part of it. Having the right, not only having the right physicians have the right training in primary care, but also having access to the different specialties and surgeons that could help trans people really feel comfortable in their own skin.
Well, and then navigating people to those providers. Not every primary care provider is going to learn how to do trans medicine. But we know who's doing it. So our trans health navigators, when somebody calls in and they say, I want primary care, I want top surgery, I want breast reduction, I want breast augmentation, things like that, we know who to send them to, and can direct them to people who, you know, not only have the clinical specialization, but also the personality and the temperament and the understanding and compassion for those folks. So that type of navigation is really important. We've also done a lot of work around working with payers to make sure that the insurance companies are paying for medications and procedures, not requiring prior authorizations and a lot of cumbersome kind of pre-work that has to be done at every step of transition. And then to begin to pay for things like, you know, feminization, voice coaching, even gait training and things like that, that are really important for someone to be able to really successfully transition and be successful in society.
And then can you share any other health disparities that may be affecting LGBTQIA people?
Certainly. One of the largest would be mental health issues. Just imagine growing up being afraid to tell someone that you're gay, bisexual, lesbian, or transgender. I grew up in the Roman Catholic Church where I was consistently told that gay people would go to hell. I think that lends itself to depression, anxiety, and especially suicidal ideation. We know that LGBTQIA folks are much higher risks of doing a suicidal gesture than the regular population. So both depression, anxiety, and suicide gestures in the gestures and completions in the LGBTQIA community are much higher than the regular population.
Yeah, I mean, so mental health, absolutely. I would be remiss to say if I didn't remind everybody that we are in the midst of a backlash against these communities. When I grew up, I grew up in places where it was a criminal act to have sex with another man, and you could be in prison for it, and people were. That wasn't all that long ago. The gay rights movement really, you know, kind of like changed the direction of that and fought for legal statuses and legal rights that they deserve. Those are currently being attacked again in a number of places. So my daughter grew up, you know, in a world and in an environment where that fear didn't exist and that stigma didn't really exist in her world. But if you're out there and you're a trans kid or a gay kid and you're reading the news about, you know, don't say gay, or, you know, it's child abuse to treat your child for a gender dysphoria, it's got to be frightening. I mean, we're moving backwards, and that's going to have severe impacts on the ability of people to access quality health care, to feel comfortable accessing care, and to worry about the criminal implications of, you know, living their life in the way that they want to live their life. So this is a serious issue right now. And it's creating a lot of trauma for people and a lot of fear and a lot of backpedaling around being out and being comfortable and feeling safe in the world.
Beyond the depression, anxiety, and suicidality, there are other disparities in the community. The community is much more likely to drink just because the primary socialization of the community has been for a long time around bars. Besides alcohol, there's more drug use. In some subpopulations, especially in gay men, there's a huge problem with methamphetamine. I've seen friends of mine who just spiraled out of control on meth. You think that would be a younger person, like that's somebody in their 20s. Friends in their 50s that spiraled out of control, lost their job, lost a lot of friends, family, you know, and that's a big problem. Also in gay men, sometimes we idealize what a perfect body looks like. And so, you know, steroid use can be pretty high in the subpopulation in gay men. So there's a lot of things that are problematic.
And then what advice would you give to the physicians, the clinicians, the emergency department professionals who are treating LGBTQIA people?
First and foremost, you got to keep your mind open. Make people feel included and welcome no matter what they appear to look like, or what they believe in. So that has to be, you just got to remove all judgment. And that's really important. The other thing I think for physicians, I'm a family physician. I work at Forbes Family Medicine, so family medicine residency. And I often will hear residents say, well, I'm apprehensive about treating trans people because I'm afraid I'm going to say the wrong thing. I'm going to misgender them. And I always just tell people, you don't have to worry about it if you can recognize you made a mistake and apologize about it. I've been working with trans folks for 15 years now. And I still sometimes mess up. In the community, as long as you're willing to take a look at yourself and say, you know what, I made a mistake, I apologize, and move forward and correct yourself, that is something that the community really, really just values. Someone who's willing to learn.
Yeah, I agree. Be nice. Ask questions. Like, if you're not sure what's going on, ask the question, because most people will appreciate a direct question, whether even if it's about, you know, a really kind of personal sexual issue. If you dance around it and feel uncomfortable or look judgy, you know, the person's just going to be like, I ain't telling you nothing. So if you don't know what, you know, if somebody uses a sexual slang term and you don't know what it is, just ask, right? It's fascinating. You learn a lot, believe me, if you ask questions. You can't eliminate judgment. Like, we can't just wipe out all the stuff that we've been taught and coded growing up in this society, but you can sure wipe it off your face. So I tell people to just look in the mirror and practice taking the judgment off their face. Can't take it out of the cortex, but just take it off the face.
And then for people who have maybe been traditionally excluded or stigmatized within the healthcare space, how would you recommend they get back into seeing a healthcare professional or seeking HIV care?
That's a great question. I think that there's a few answers to that. First, I think that LGBTQIA folks can look for folks that have an LGBT champion status. And that's one of the things that we did at Allegheny Health Network is we actually have a designation for a champion status for all of our physicians who are LGBT champions. So if they simply look on our Find a Doctor website, so if you, no matter what insurance you have or what you're involved in, if you just look for someone who is an LGBT champion or whatever they would name it, I think that's going to be helpful in getting back into the system, and know that you're not going to be judged or discriminated, and someone's going to be looking out for your own well-being. I think that sometimes folks just need to take a leap of faith. I think that the medical community as a whole has been much better trained. Medical schools are doing a much better job at teaching people to use the right pronouns, teaching people what the disparities are in the community. So people are a little bit more aware. And I think that they have a friendly status. And I think that if someone would take that leap of faith and go to see a physician, I think people are more willing to actually learn with them. So if they don't know, they're willing to pick up the knowledge base to help them get the best quality care.
Well, thank you so much for this conversation and for sharing your insights.
That's not a problem. And thank you, Stuart, also for joining the conversation.
What infectious disease disparities do you want covered next? We want to hear from you, so please feel free to send feedback to me at ncosdon@mjhlifesciences.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Contagion Community.